Number 57. See? Yeah.
Alan West.
Idiot.
Well, what is he talking about? I don't even know how.
Well, no, it turns out he says, they asked him for details. What I was talking about was the House Progressive Caucus. That's how many people they've got in it. Well, no, yeah, okay, dimwit, but now we'll be needing the proof that they are members of the Communist Party. Can you do that? Well, no, they're Democrats. Okay, let's try this again. I realize you're a little bit slow, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
You said they're communists. We need, and I know this is a word that you're not familiar with, we need proof. And, of course, you know, necessarily he then will go where Donald Trump went in front of the... I'm the proof. I'm the expert. I've been recognized all over the world for all the stuff I know about tourism because I got hotels, right? I'm the expert. Well, I'm the proof. I said there's 81 or 92... communists in the house. That's your proof.
That's your proof.
If you throw her in water and if you throw them in water and they float, they're communists, I tell you.
No doubt. Yeah. Oh,
these great comedies that we love so well are proving to be prophecies instead.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
I mean, how bad is it? I ran that clip before the program, and I saw Willard tell these college kids to take a chance. And I was suddenly transported to days in my misspent college youth when, you know, because you didn't always have a date on Friday night, you're sitting in the room watching a precious videotape that nobody had, and you had to, like, go to the public library and research things and find a company, and you own it, and it's The Bank Dick by W.C. Fields, and you're watching him sit there, take a chance, take it while you're young. My uncle, Effingham Huffnagel, an air ascensionist, took a chance. He took a chance that he could jump out of a balloon from 3,500 feet and land in a pile of hay. Well, did he make it? No, it's precisely my point. Had he been a younger man, he might have. And that's the politics of 2012, and that film was made in 1935.
Yeah. That's how much they're reaching, they're grasping.
Oh, they're selling beef. The Republicans are selling beefsteak mines.
I mean, does this resonate with anyone? I mean,
I don't even know if that, I do that stuff, and I don't even know if it resonates here in the Horn family, because it is admittedly obscure, but God, it's true.
No, not what you said, what he says. That's what I want to know, is what he says something that resonates with anyone other than the obvious.
I mean, I don't think everybody sitting in that room at Otterbein College, I don't think that they were all there because mommy and daddy were writing the check. I suspect that there's a substantial number of people at Otterbein who are there on student loans.
And he's in support of what, doubling the rate?
Yeah, he's in support of borrowing the money from your mother and your father.
Yeah, so he can only pay 13% tax? And give what? What did he give?
I mean, this is, you know, this is one of those media follow-up moments. I'd like to know if anybody stood up and said, Willard? We're on a, I can call you Willard. You can call me Fred because, you know, you're unemployed and I'm a college student. We're in the same place, right? Your sons have a $100 million trust fund that you've never paid and they won't pay a penny of tax on. Did you do that so that they wouldn't have to borrow from you when they went to college? I mean, how does that happen? Because I need to tell my mom and dad how they can set up a $100 million trust fund for me. Well, that's easy, son. First, you take $100 million. You know, it's like that old gag about burglars, the recipe for burglars' chicken.
Okay, I don't know that one.
Okay, the first step in it's delicious burglars' chicken. and the first step in burglar's chicken is first steal a chicken.
Oh, I should have known that one.
Yeah, you kind of saw it coming from a couple of miles away.
Yeah.
But, you know, well, you want to set up a $100 million trust fund for your kids? Well, first get $100 million. Oh, well, okay. And then Willard, what?
Yeah. Well, it's like the Kids in the Hall sketch, remember, when they're giving the money, make money speeches in Seattle, where they usually give them in Seattle. And they talk about, you know, was anyone in a trailer park that burned down? I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
Anyway, that's what's resonated in my mind. Yeah, is anyone who burned in a trailer park? Well, the bank, they owe you $100,000, and don't let the bank tell you different. That's the whole, you know. I mean,
I hear Kids in the Hall, and all I hear is I'm squeezing your head.
Yeah, it's kind of squeezing. Yeah, well, of course they're squeezing your head. Those guys are all about psychology. And, you know, I mean, it really, yeah. I mean, and the reason I guess it resonates with me is because instead of, you know, I've never been in a position to steal a chicken, but I have been in a position to be in one of those stupid seminars.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's real. It's pretty much real. And then, of course, they always want to sell you their music that they make, which, of course, propels me into Best of Show with Captain and Tate. It's just, wow, delish. Wow, wow.
Oh, how I love it. No, he really has two left feet.
He does have two left feet. I mean, and it,
what a beautiful special effect that was, just to show him walking away like that.
Yeah, those are some gem films. If you haven't seen all those, that Cruise films of, you know, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, you know, Spinal Tap is their first, I think their
Mighty
first
Wind hit. Absolutely destroyed
Mighty
me.
Wind. Oh, yeah, Mighty Wind was great. Mighty Wind was excellent. I haven't seen it enough, actually. I need to watch it a few more times. But, yeah, I mean, and that's what these, come on, we'll borrow from your parents. Your parents ain't got shit. They ain't got shit. I'm lucky to have what I have, and I barely have nothing. I have nothing. I mean, goodness gracious, I got a window, and I got a pot, and I can
throw it out.
Throw it
out the window, right.
That's about what I got, and I got, you know, I do have a father, and I do have parents, you know, mother-in-laws, even though I got to deal with all that craziness. But, you know, we'll see. You know, hopefully it's, I've been doing math and doing this and doing that, so hopefully I can make what I think I can make. I mean, 25 pizzas is, a day is, you know, that's good. That's actually, you know, if you do the math, it's kind of substantial. So, I mean, especially from in my world, you know, I mean, that would just be, you know, complete, you know, it would be like, it would do to me what paying a fair price for coffee does for people in Ethiopia. You know, just paying them, I mean, just doubling the 4 cents for 2.5 kilos that they were getting would completely revolutionize their life. And then to pay them actually 50 cents or $1, $1.25 is unbelievable for these people. It's almost like they have oil under the ground now. And they can get clean water, and they can sit here and buy and think about buying solar panels and having electricity and actually going from subsistence farming hand to mouth, constant starvation and war and strife, to going to having a more advanced communication system than the president did in 1975 or more. And I mean, the president had it in 1990. You know what I mean? These are the kind of things that just a little tiny bit of effort and a little bit of, you know, consciousness can change. And the better that those worlds are, the more that those people have, the less we have to worry about Iran and a bomb. The less we have to worry about Iran wanting a bomb. Because we all know on the horn that Iran probably would be the most tactical decision for them would be to not have a freaking bomb. Because to have a bomb would just invite attack. To even have 1/1,000,000th of a parts per billionth of, you know, plutonium-199 or whatever, 290, whatever the frick it is. You know, to even have that shows that they're trying to refine to a bomb would mean their total obliteration. And I think that civilization...
And I think the Iranians do understand that the people who blow people up, who are in the blowing people up business over here, don't give up about them. Insofar as, you know, we're not, okay, no, we're not just going to bomb the scientists. We're not just going to, and Jesus, that's just crazy to say. We're not just going to bomb the Ayatollah. We're going to bomb 5-year-olds. Yeah, we're going to, because that's the way bombs work, Albert.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, we're going to, Yeah, we're gonna bomb the pharmacist, we're gonna bomb the gas station attendant, we're gonna bomb the mommies, we're gonna bomb the swing sets, we're gonna bomb the swimming pools, we're gonna bomb the gardens, we're gonna bomb everything.
With one bomb.
There are two.
And that's what they're looking at.
Yeah.
Yeah? I mean, come on. I mean, this is what we're looking at. We know we come on. And honestly, yeah, just like David was saying earlier, that's propaganda. You know, we all know it's propaganda. Nobody buys that. Who the hell buys that? For real? Nobody's going to war with Iran. We're not supporting that. That level of fear in this country isn't there anymore, and everyone can feel it. Just look. Just, it's right in front of you right now. It's in your chest. You really feel that? It's not like Iraq, and it's certainly not like Afghanistan was. The level of...
Although, I guess, who is it? Bob Kerry, who isn't exactly anybody I'd call liberal, but he's running for Senate in Nebraska. He had the unmitigated gall the other day to say that invading Iran would make Iraq look like a cakewalk. Of course, remember we were promised that we would be welcomed as liberators in Iraq. That's what all those explosions going off were. Those were celebratory fireworks celebrating us liberating. And I guess we just happened to get a little too close to them once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and be honest, you know, I mean, let's be real straight. The Iraq war was going on for what? I mean, that, if you count to when we start pulling out, it was going on from day one to the end of Desert Storm until whenever all the troops are gone.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
think about that.
Yeah, are we really ready to invade and invest and occupy Iran?
No.
No, because I don't know. See, I don't think we can.
No. No. I mean, we can certainly contain them from attacking us, but we
even
cannot.
And that assumes, of course, that there's some minute microscopic shred of evidence that they have any interest at all in doing that. Now, if we want to make them want to attack us, there is one way of making sure that happens. And that's by dropping some bombs on some florists and gas station workers and maybe some children at a playground. Then they'll want to attack us, and they'll hate us for, a millennium or two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I talked the other night about this, the wonderful piece from The Chaser's War on Everything from Australia that I found over at Crooks and Liars. It was this brilliant little visual piece. The question being, where can you leave a Trojan horse? And they successfully left it at a race course. They left it in front of the Sydney Opera House. Oh, yeah, park it over there by the concrete block. We've got traffic problems here.
Yeah.
They successfully left it in front of the history faculty at Sydney University.
Yeah.
And every time they successfully left it somewhere, this big rubber stamp would be permission granted. And then they pulled up, and this, I'm going to go ahead and ruin the joke. I mentioned it. If anybody hasn't been there to see it, it's too damn late. Then they pulled up in front of, I mean, you remember where Troy was, right?
Yeah.
It's located where Turkey is now.
Yeah, Turkey, yeah.
So they pulled up in front, of the Turkish embassy. We've got this Trojan horse here, and we'd like to leave it, you know, it's a gift from the Greeks. We'd like to leave it here in front of your place. Is that all right? I'll have to ask the consul general. 2 minutes later, this functionary comes out and says, no, you can't leave that here. Permission denied. And it was the only place that denied them. And that's a memory that is 3,184 years old.
Mm. Well.
Anybody wants to leave a horse in front of your place? No, don't let them.
Yeah.
And it's a memory 3 millennia old.
It doesn't even work today. 3,000 years ago it worked. Today it doesn't work. Calling Barack Hussein Obama, you know, a Muslim socialist with his time machine, that shit don't work. It doesn't work. It's too late. It's over. And they just keep going, and they just keep getting crazier, and they keep reaching back in history, and they pulled up 1957, McCarthy, let's go back to Hitler, it's Hitler, we're gonna go back to, all the way to George Washington, let's go back to Zeus. I mean, they've lost it. They're going the wrong direction. They've always been going in the wrong direction. The only direction we can go is forward. And, you know, that's what they're conservatives about. You know, they're just, they're disconnected. They're not even plugged in. They're almost like running, it's like a friggin' toy that you give your kids that just runs automatically, you know, and it's like the Energizer Bunny, but it's going zik-chi, zik-chi. It's just the batteries are running out. These people don't even have it anymore. We've been saying for years that they're not, their feet aren't even on the frigging ground, and it's racist this and racist that, and this is all we go, good shot, Zimmy, and da-da-da-da-da. They're speaking in tongues of mania. These people are lost, and they're done.
They and therefore, as our buddy Reverbo says, we say, listen, folks, we've idled the bus long enough. We're sorry, but we're going to have to close the doors now and go on down the road. We'll miss
you. Here's an umbrella.
Yeah, here's an umbrella and an apple and a road map.
There you go.
Hey, Albert, it's been a wonderful Friday night, brother. Have a great weekend.
You too, brother, and you feel better. I know I said stay well, but I meant that in the best of intents.
I understand completely. I'm going to be a very broth-intensive guy over the weekend, and I will get better. All right.
Get that turmeric in there. Good for your belly. All right.
Bye now. Brother Albert, the sage of Southwest Wisconsin. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? I heard a noise. Okay. Welcome to the program.
Well, what's going on, Bob?
Hey, what's happening, Spike?
Not much. Just still recuperating from our Super Tuesday this past Tuesday here.
Yeah, and you did get rid of a horse's rear end.
Tim Holden.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was pretty good. I was actually at the victory speech and party for Matt Cartwright, as a matter of fact. Which, if Matt, and it looks very good now because he's up against a Tea Party loon, from the Republican side. So this will be the first
one of those birther, deather, tenther, booger eater types?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, someone who owns a nurse at home business from the Wilkes-Barre area. Another business crackpot.
I love the smell of urine in the morning. It smells like victory.
Yeah, so that really was the election right there. Because the Pennsylvania Republican Party gerrymandered this district to basically be all Democrats. There's a few pockets of Republicans left, but basically every precinct that went blue in 2010 got gerrymandered into this so that they could make Barletta and Marino strong. And by the way, Marino's at the, I feel stupid. I'm having a little bit of a brain fart. The Mayo Clinic. He's starting to have some real bad issues with cancer as well. So that's another congressional race to keep an eye on because the candidate's health might be starting to seriously deteriorate.
And that can be an issue. Well, is there a credible challenger?
Yeah, from the next county over, there's a Democrat, pretty good Democrat running. I forget his name, Phil Scolo, Scolio, I can't remember how to say his last name. He's Phil. He's a pretty good candidate too, but, the thing that excites me the most about Matt Cartwright, this will be the first time I have someone in Washington, should he win, that actually knows who I am. Like, literally will see me and know me as Spike Rogan. That's nice to actually for once have the feeling that, hey, I actually have someone I could actually...
Well, yeah, it is, but I mean, I got to tell you, by the same token, my congressman knows me, and it's not such a good
feeling.
Not in a
good way.
Yeah, it's not such a good feeling.
Well, you know, had I been stuck with Barletta for a long time, that might have happened to me, but luckily, as of January 2013, I'll be done with him. He'll be gone regardless of what happens in November for us here. Big sigh of relief. We have a lot of Latinos in my town here and partly in my precinct, so a very big sigh of relief to get rid of Lou Barletta around here. But, you know, I just want
he's
to point
just
out
toxic.
Something.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the Huffington Post, the day or maybe 2 days after our primary, did a piece and somewhat painted a false picture a little bit about the congressional race here. There were a lot of pro-environmental groups, people like that. The Postal Workers Union endorsed Cartwright. The Conservation League, Clean Water Action, there's a few of them. There was a PAC that went after Holden with ads. They spent at least $200,000 probably. It was the Center for Primary Accountability. Most of the donors for that are like Big Oil, Energy, Eric Cantor is a big donor to that PAC. And so the right wing and their foolish Beltway experts who never came to the area to figure this one out for themselves seem to think that their crackpot candidate would do better against a newcomer than Holden, because I'm willing to bet that what they probably say is, well, we haven't been able to beat him while he was in a very Republican strong precinct. But since they redistricted him into a very Democratic strong district, it's going to be hard for them to win. So why they spent all that money to defeat Holden is beyond me, since Holden would have voted for them. But I would just like to thank them for once again. The far right in this country is great at signing their own political death warrant, whether it's the war on women or things like this, where like they're going to get rid of the guy who would vote for them and inadvertently make a congressional district more than likely to be won by someone who's going to oppose them. So I would just like to thank those idiots for defeating Tim Holden, their guy.
And see, that's they are. They're idiots. And it's the same syndrome where, you, like I mentioned last night, you go out to Utah, and in his primary, the Orrin Hatch in Utah could not get a 51% majority in his primary, because there are a bunch of pissed-off teabaggers that think he isn't ideologically pure enough because... I don't know, last year sometime he was seen actually speaking to one of those liberals, you know, a Democrat. You know, even if the so-called liberal Democrat was, I don't know, Joe Manchin.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just hilarious in that I think they've become so distorted in their primary races by the Tea Party. Some of them have lost fact reality. That doesn't apply in many general elections any longer. The Tea Party fat has died. It's not what it once was. It's becoming a smaller and smaller because these people were easily disenfranchised because they didn't get everything they wanted immediately, so therefore a lot of them have quickly given up.
Well, that's why I've said for a long time that they are, politically speaking, babies.
Yeah, and you know, especially in this precinct here, or in this, our state representative district that we have here within this congressional district, there was an effort by the local Republican who the last two times he ran for state rep, there was no Democrats on the ticket, so he ran writing campaigns to get on both party tickets. In 08, he did quite well with single party Democratic voters riding Obama's coattail, even though he's a far right wing, can't wait to see him go sort of representative in the state capitol for me here. And this time around, we have a legitimate Democrat who was on the ballot, and he tried to run a writing campaign against her, and it looks like as the count's going, he's going to end up failing miserably and having spent a lot of money to lose a writing campaign because he seems to feel there's going to be blue coattails to ride come this general election. This will be the first time in a long time he's had an opponent during a presidential election year. I believe 2004 was the last time. Because 08 was the last presidential election he ran, and he got the Democratic nomination, got some union endorsements, which is pathetic. This will be the first time since 04 he's had an opponent. In 04, a lot of people here were bamboozled into supporting the GOP in those days. The demographics have kind of changed a little bit from the area from then, on top of the fact that many people are just sick of Republicans' BS. So I think that's another clear indication that the right wing, they don't know what's going on. They can't figure out how to win elections. Here's someone desperately hoping he can fool people into thinking he's a Democrat to win an election. I mean, and this is the slickest they got going, and it's not very slick at all. It's a party of dysfunction that is just going to continue to fall apart because they've moved too far to the right. It's actually laughable. Just like it was laughable, Democratic committee person from Schuylkill County, Holdens County, said, oh, this indicates that the Democratic Party has moved further to the left. No, it's that some people are just so far to the right, even those in the middle of the road can't take it anymore. And I think this is just going to further hurt the Republicans. There's a rally in Harrisburg tomorrow. My mother's going. There's a, like, activist bus or something like that, where you pay so much per person to take a good bus, not a school bus, to the state capitals of Pennsylvania, I think New York, Connecticut. All tomorrow, there's going to be rallies at state capitals about the war on women, which the more the Republicans go after women, the bigger mistake they're making, because the two groups I see the most when I do poll security coming in on a regular basis voting are old people, and everyone knows that one, and women. Younger men in their 30s through late 40s, I believe, just don't show up in as more loyal numbers of voting as women in that age group. I think that's the biggest critical mistake they keep making, is they don't realize just because your primary is dominated by men, come general election time, there's going to be a lot of women voting. You know, they think everyone has the same short-term memory their own base has. You know, these right-wingers, they only remember what they heard 30 seconds ago. That's why
I laugh, but it is absolutely undeniably true. That's why they can run around saying things like, well, that one, you know, that Kenyan Muslim, he destroyed our economy.
That's right. Well, that's why Mitt Romney could go to a factory closed in Juneau 2008 and say it was Obama's fault. Yeah. Did you hear that one he did in Ohio?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he understands.
And my personal favorite of all the things in the political spectrum this week.
I mean, there are silverback gorillas in zoos who know how to remember which buttons to press in order to make the head of celery roll out the chute. Okay, they've got more more acumen than the average teabagger voter has.
Is that why Newt keeps going to these zoos every place he goes on the tail end of his campaign? His retirement tour? Is that why he gave us such an advance notice? This is like his Arrivederci tour when Mario Andretti retired from racing. This is Newt retiring from being a loser.
Yeah, see, I looked this up a minute ago. I had to share it with you because it's right on topic. I had an email exchange with Mark out in Indiana earlier today. And, you know, because I've been talking about how I've decided that my gallbladder is the little Republican that lives in my belly.
Okay.
And, he says, yeah, it's there's scarring too. There will be scarring. But he went on and he said a couple of bumper stickers on a scowling old lady's car at the little grocery store, here in Indiana. Bumper sticker number one, and of course you've got a scowling little old lady. Bumper sticker number one, Tea Party. No longer racist, no longer violent, no longer silent. And then bumper sticker number two, you are not entitled to the money that I earned. Mark said, what a nice lady. Does that mean they used to be racist and violent? Does she qualify as a walking gallbladder? And yes, she absolutely does. She is a walking gallbladder.
Yeah, I'm no longer racist. Hey, we were, but, you know, we because you people complained, we took care of it.
Unless the Bruins are getting beaten in the seventh game of the first round of the playoffs.
Well, welcome to Boston sports fans. If I'm correct, the Red Sox fans were also historically not too kind to their early black players
I seem to recall a certain Bill Russell having a few problems when he went to the Celtics.
Yeah, well, it's funny, too, because that was the city that kind of crossed the barrier for basketball, and yet that was the city that has the biggest problems for when it comes to kind of racist fans. Like, look at the Red Sox game. I mean, that crowd, it looks like they just left the hoods at home, man. There's not too many non-white people in that crowd. Lots of white people at Red Sox games. Although, I guess, again, it's so expensive to go to Red Sox games, that should explain everything. It's like floor seats in an NBA game. It's just so expensive. Good luck seeing many minorities there, because they're not in that income bracket to pay those kind of prices as well.
But I love that bumper sticker. No longer racist, no longer violent, no longer silent. That implies, as Mark noted, does that mean they used to be racist and violent? Well, yes, it does. And it also means they used to be silent. And what I pointed out to Mark is these people have not been silent since their parents were taking them to John Birch meetings and Klan rallies.
They certainly haven't.
Because they are the same people, Spike. They are the same people.
Yeah, they were making plenty of noise with the racist thing. That's how we noticed that, actually. Had they been quiet, then we might have missed it. But they were plenty loud when the bone through the lips or the nose and the one sign of Obama and all these horrific racial.
Well, yeah, and that button at the immigration debate in front at the protests in front of the Supreme Court for the immigration arguments the other day, the SB 1070 Arizona arguments. That one button. Don't blame me. I voted for the American.
The American. I voted for the American.
Yeah, even though, I mean, if we want to talk about birthplaces, Barack Obama was actually born in Florida, whereas if, and I don't want to make myself sound like a weirdo, but this is a fact. If you look at where John McCain was born and they want to have that argument.
Yeah, he was born in another country.
He was,
military,
well, no, it's worse than that. John McCain was born in Panama, okay, because that's where his father was stationed. All right? Okay.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's not a person's fault. I mean, but he was born on a military base, so that's a part of America, right? Wrong. He wasn't born on a military base. He was born in a Panamanian off-base hospital. He was born on Panamanian soil. But,
well,
you know, he's really palely, pathetically white and cranky and old, so he must be an American.
And an Arizonian to boot, because those people, they're so angry about people trying to take over their country from them. Which is kind of hilarious, since, like, you know, how Arizona was obtained. And for that matter, how the West was, quote, won. My cousin did a parody video, actually, for his college class, where he really was mocking that Arizona governor.
Yeah, the Gadsden so-called purchase.
Yeah, so, I mean, and his video was actually about invasive species and trees, but there was a lot of political satire about immigration in that video. It's pretty hilarious. Big fake mustache and just some great one-liners.
Fake mustaches are always fun.
Yeah, and before I go, I just want to point out back to the hot topic of the first hour, or the first half hour of calls, about sandwich shops. Yeah, as far as chain places go, actually Jimmy John's hoagies are really good. The cold cuts are better than the other big chain. It's a shame the owner is the right wing, but to be honest, that's not a surprise. I suspect probably about 85% of all chain.
Yeah, they probably all are.
Yeah, they'd be very rare to find someone who's probably not really ultra. You're probably more likely to find a libertarian than a liberal in the chain business for the most part. But I'll give them that. I always, when I lived in Easton, went there frequently. It was one of the few places where you could get alfalfa sprouts as one of the toppings on your hoagie when you order it.
Oh, yummy.
Well, yeah, like hot peppers and all kinds of good stuff. Awesome pickles as well. I'm a big,
you know, I can't
fan.
Wait for the show to end so I can have the off.
But and Five Guys is the best burger chain.
Yeah.
Actually, Not too badly priced, considering what you're getting there compared to other burgers.
Now, see, I think back, though, to, you know, the places that I've loved. You know, my favorite hamburger is available only in one place on the planet. It's just available only there. It's a little bit of nothing. It's a little storefront joint in East Florence, Alabama, called Stags' Grocery. And it is the God burger. It really, really is. And, you know, if I start to thinking about some of the best subs I ever had, it didn't come from a chain. It's when I was a student up in Morgantown, and we would walk down the mountain, literally, to this place called the Spruce Street Sub Shop. And there was only one of them. I mean, there weren't even two in Morgantown. There was just one of them. And the bread was magnificent because it came from some obscure bakery in Pittsburgh. And the meat was good, and everything was just right about them. And I had one, though, a few years ago, last time I was up there, and they're still that good.
Yeah, well, that's the great thing about mom-and-pop sandwich joints in Philly is the hoagies generally have awesome rolls, because most places use a baker out of, it's a big baker, but it's a very regional big baker out of South Jersey called Amoroso, no relation to the one from Trump, and it's an Italian company, I believe. And
sounds Irish to me, but I'm joking.
Yeah, but they are the brand who makes the specific special recipe ones for both Pat's and Gino's, and many other places use them as well. They're really, really a nice, like, crisp outside but soft inside.
Yeah, see, that's what's got to happen.
The best, and actually Jimmy John's bread's pretty similar to that in a way, but the best place for any sandwich whatsoever, it's not a chain for me, but down in the South Philly Italian market, a place called George's. So they've even been featured on PBS and things like that. I love Italian sausage, and you could get a cheesesteak all over Philly, but they offer an Italian sausage sandwich that is just awesome. You can get it really hot, and on my menu, the hottest one they have is Burn My Ass, where they put, like, actual whole long hot peppers on the
whole.
Awesome. They have Italian tripe there, and they have the best Italian roast pork in Philadelphia.
Oh, stop it.
Even
stop
have broccoli wrap.
Like, yeah, that's like going to South Florida, going down to Little Havana or somewhere and getting a Cuban pulled pork sandwich. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, the place kind of looks ratty. They only have, like, at best maybe 8 seats in the place. Most of their business is just
people. Those are the special places. You know, being in the Strip District in Pittsburgh and walking into Permanis.
Permanis has even kind of somewhat been corporatized and
yeah, but that you know, one original one down in the Strip District is still the, you know, yeah. 4 hours, seedy as hell, you know, oh, Jesus.
But yeah, so if you ever find yourself in Philadelphia, Philly, Georgia's, they're only open from like, I think, 10:30 in the morning to 5 at night. Lunchtime place. But
yeah, and you had a lot of favorite burger. I think they close by 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah. And also, what you were saying about barbecue places, spot on, man. If you can't smell that place from a little bit of a distance, it's not that good. There was a place in Easton you could smell from the road when you were just within a certain distance of it. Awesome. They did more like a Carolina-style barbecue, North Carolina, really.
Yeah, with the tangy vinegar base.
Also.
Yeah, oh, man.
Yeah, but yeah, vinegar base. They did great pork. And there's a guy by me here, and even though he's a giant right-winger, I still once in a while give him money, because actually he does do awesome beef brisket. I've had a beef brisket from a few barbecue places up north here, and that's like kind of an art many people still haven't figured out up north. They've figured out the pork. But the beef is a different deal. But he makes great beef brisket. So I overlook our political differences for the beef brisket. It's outrageous. And that's another place you can smell it before you're that close to it. You just driving by it on especially windy days, you can smell it for a little bit further down.
Yeah, if you can't, that means that this. No, I mean I'm as against pollution as anybody, but that hickory smoke is just. Perfume.
Well, wood smoke is better for the environment and the carbons it releases as opposed to from combustible engines.
Oh, sure. Like yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, there's an argument to be made. It's actually healthier than places that use gas to barbecue in many ways. Especially since here we actually have a big problem with the ash borer beetle who has decimated many of our trees around here. So we kind of need to get rid of a lot of wood. So this guy locally is actually using a very local tree that's been kind of destroyed by the beetles, but it's nice and dry, which makes it pretty good for using to barbecue with, and it's pretty plentiful around here. So he's not really using like a hickory or, you know, these traditional. That might be the other thing too, is it's a very unique local. And it's not ash trees that they're eating up here. It's another tree, somewhat defying the science behind what these beetles eat. I can't think of the name of the tree. It's like a smooth gray tree, the bark of it.
Birch?
No, they're not birch. They're not white. It's like a silver tree.
Huh. Some sort of poplar?
I'm not sure the name of something.
Okay, so now we have tonight's trivia research topic for the horn. And the name of the beetle again?
The ash borer beetle. It's like a neon metallic green beetle.
Ash? It's an ash tree.
But I don't think they are ash trees that are around here. That's the thing.
Huh. Well, no, it's probably some beetle that used to be only able to live in a climate where the temperature never, you know, where the temperature never rose above whatever, or, you know, didn't drop below or whatever, and it's been able to come south, you know, because there's no climate change, right, Spike? I mean, isn't that about how it works?
Yeah, or maybe move north. I'm not even sure. I think it's something coming from the north, though, in this case. But, and interestingly enough, in my town, the Army has a facility here that does a lot in electronics, so therefore they probably have a lot of pallets coming in and out. And the hugest areas of contamination where it just looks like nuclear bombs went off is right near their entrances. So I'm willing to take a wild guess on who is the culprit behind the infested wood coming to this area. But yeah, so it's needless to say that that's the other thing interesting about that guy's beef brisket is it's probably a flavor you only really taste around here because it's the local trees from around here, which is cool in many ways as well because a lot of these other barbecue places buy their wood from very far away, which involves a lot of trucking it and stuff. And I have to admit myself, well, sometimes there's local places that grow trees and then cook, shred them up to sell as chips. There's a good chance I'm probably guilty of that as anyone else, since I like to use generally a mix of cherry and hickory when I do smoking on my own in here. And using I use Royal Crown briquettes mixed with another brand of lump coal when I do it.
Yeah, I love the I forget the name of it, but there's a brand of charcoal that's done very environmentally friendly, and it's out of Kentucky, and it's made out of old pallets. So it's hardwood, and it, you can see that it's old pallets. But it burns hot and it burns clean, and that I'll make my base fire out of that, and then add my hickory to it as I'm smoking. Hey Spike, I'm starving to death. Albert just suggested give Spike a toaster, but make him stop torturing you about food. More broth.
Well, instead, close your eyes tonight, and instead of taste the chicken broth, just think of the taste of some Carolina style pork.
Get the ashtray, and I've got some hickory chips outside, and I'll just set fire to a hickory chip, and I'll breathe hickory smoke while I'm drinking my chicken broth.
And then you got barbecue chicken.
And who could ask for anything more? Spike, have a great weekend, brother.
Hey, you too. Later.
Later. Bye now. That's our buddy Spike calling from PA. I love this stuff because these kind of conversations, I've got this little list in my head of, you know, if I show up somewhere, I know where to go to, right. And so, you know, I'll be needing my suggestions for Boston and Charlotte, please. You know, great non-corporate places to go that, you know, assuming I'm eating food by then, of course. Hey, where's the best chicken broth in Boston, right? But, you know, all this sandwich stuff. I guess the one thing we left out was the classic Chicago Italian beef. You want that wet? Yeah, I want it wet. Spicy. You want the peppers? I want the peppers. Let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program. Nobody. Hey, welcome to the program.
I'm back.
Oh, it's Tracy. You're out of the tunnel.
Motherfucking AT&T. I know you've missed me. Just me saying motherfucker probably just brightens your day.
It does. And it's Friday, too, so that makes it extra special, Tracy.
Well,
it's MF and Friday.
Yeah, it's MF and Friday, yes. So I guess when you were talking, somebody said something about a man crush on Van Jones. Is that?
Yeah, they said you definitely were manifesting the symptoms of a Van Jones man crush.
Yeah, well, considering, yeah. But, and by the way, not only did he talk about, you know, the political thing, you know, one of the things that got me about what he talked about was what is truly a patriot. He's like, you know, he watches these people come to New York, and the first thing they do is go to the Statue of Liberty and look at, you know, and say, this is America, you know. And then he's like, well, did y'all look at the little inscription, you know, on the thing that says, give me your tithe, you're poor, give me your muddle, you know, your muddled masses, yearning to breathe free, you know, and because, of course, you know, that was what this country was built on, was immigration. You know, of course, the immigrants that are coming in now are the wrong color.
Well, and that's really the problem now, isn't it?
Yes. You know, those brown people.
Well, I don't know how, since I have you on the line, and since you are no one can turn you away from this ugly, ugly habit that you have of reading books, Tracy. and I don't know how much you've been listening lately.
Mm-hmm.
I have to tell you that for about the last month and a half, leading up to a conversation, three Mondays back, two Mondays back, I've been talking about this magnificent book called 1493.
No. Oh, no, I never heard of it. Oh, before I forget, here's another book that you guys need to put on your reading list.
Uh-huh.
The Warmth of Other Suns.
The Warmth of Other Suns.
Oh, the way you said you've never... Okay, basically, it's written by the first black woman.
No, the reason I said it that way was because we had a little MF and AT&T breakup there.
Okay, yeah, The Warmth of Other Suns. Basically, it was written by a black woman who was the first black woman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. Pulitzer Prize in Literature for journalists. She spent 14 years documenting the great black migration from the South to parts of, to the North, to Detroit, Chicago, to New York, and of course to the West, to L.A. It's the most magnificent thing I have ever read in my life.
Isabel Wilkerson.
Yes. And I met her.
Oh.
She did a book signing here in L.A. And, because the thing about, about black people and, because people just think we were slaves, but what these people did, because they just could not handle, they knew that in order for their children and for their family to have a chance in this country, they had to escape the South. Not leave.
Escape.
Just say, I'm leaving and moving to California or whatever. I'm transplanting myself. No. Escape. Running for their lives. Okay, now go back to what you're saying.
Okay, well, I have to tell you, Albert just wrote in and said, don't let her take it wrong. Tell Tracy I have a massive bromance for Van Jones myself, so. As Albert, because Van listens. Every now and then, Van uses phrases that get used on the horn first, so sometimes I think he does tune in. It just.
Oh, Van does! Awesome,
yeah.
Awesome!
Well, I mean, you won't know, and you wouldn't dare tell old Bob because then he'd get the big head or something, right?
He did talk about, about the country. He's like, you cannot say you're a patriot and love this country if you're poor. And when the first thing he said, wait for it, mountaintop removal!
See, it was, he was talking about it some, back in 2009 at Power Shift in D.C., Tracy. And I was working backstage, and I just sort of walked up to him, grabbed him, shook his hand, said, yeah, we gotta get you to Appalachia. You're doing a good job. We gotta make it plainer that we're being sacrificed here. We're being killed here. He said, I'm on it. And he's been real good about talking about it to people who otherwise wouldn't know about it. But you know what? Here's the cool part. There you were sitting at that lecture in L.A., MF in L.A. because it's Friday. And he said mountaintop removal, and you knew exactly what he was talking about. And you could put that hand in the air and say, tell it.
And I pretty much said, I think I said, preach, brother, preach. I think I said that. I think I might have said a couple of amens, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the process.
Oh, Albert wrote it. That seals it. Hi, Van. We love you.
See? Like I said. So tell me about this book, 1493. Is it on Amazon?
I've got it on my Kindle.
Can I get it on my Kindle?
Yeah, it is brain warping, Tracy. I don't recommend books on the horn unless I've just, you've got to, unless it's really just all over me like poison ivy. It's got a sister book, a precursor book, 1491. You don't have to read that to read 1493, but it helps.
Let me guess, because, every so often I do pick up a history book, and in the 1492, Christopher Columbus told the ocean blue. So let me think.
No. In 1492, Columbus screwed the natives blue.
Okay. Gave them blue balls. Well, not blue balls. They didn't have...
Yeah.
Happen, they got
So basically 1491 is about the New World before Columbus gets here. 1493 is about everything that comes out of Columbus's discovery of the New World.
Including syphilis, slavery.
thing, I won't even try, Tracy. I'm talking about things that you, I mean, it is mind-bending from one page to the next, and you're going, holy shit.
Well, like I said, it was the same thing when I was reading, because, you know, as quiet as it's kept, black people, you know, because I have relatively young parents, and basically when I was, up until I was 20, there was five living generations. My great-great-grandmother was still alive until I was in my 20s. So I had my great-great-grandmother, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mom. Ask me if I know anything about my history.
Yeah, see? And that's why, like, with this book, he spends a substantial amount of time laying out in very well-written prose, in ways that are undeniable, the effect of, and the reasons for the transportation of and expansion of African, an African presence in the New World. And he makes the argument that the New World was shaped not by white folks.
No shit, really?
Yeah, he says, you know, he said, there's a passage in there where Charles C. Mann, the author, says, the roads were built by African people. The waterways were plied by barges run by African people. The language was shaped, you know, one of these mush mouth goober cracker southerners, you know, talks like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the proportionality of black to white in the South in early America was, Jesus, like 11-1.
Right.
So English was shaped. The way we speak English in the United States was shaped by African immigrants. And they're immigrants, whether they are brought here forcefully or of their own free will. It is still an immigration process,
right.
A migration process.
And that was one of the things that...
And he talks about it in the context of what happened in South America, in Central America. He talks about the early steps toward some degree of liberation and freedom. And, no, you will sit down with this book, and you will, I promise you, you write to me if you don't. You sit down with this book and you start reading 1493, and you will be talking to yourself. You'll be hitting that little button on your Kindle, going, "No, really."
Oh no. Well, before I go, because I know you're well, that's the same thing about Isabel Wilkerson's book. I mean,
I got to read this
because of the fact I am, you know, I have a little bit of education, and I know why, you know, black people left the South before I read the book. But she goes into the brutality of the South. But one of the things, the reason why I don't know anything about my history, and I'm not talking about as a black person, I'm just talking about my family history, is because it was, what was happening in the South was so horrific and so brutal that no one that left there alive wanted to talk about it.
All you want to do is forget. All you want to do is forget.
All you want to do is forget. And I wish, you know, talk about knowing then what you know now situation. Had I had the idea of talk, because my great-great-grandmother, her mother was a slave. Or her grandmother was a slave. So that much I know. And that I know that she was half Indian. Don't know what, you know, what nation, because I was corrected on that. I said tribe to somebody and almost... No. You do not say tribe, you say nation. These are the things that I'm learning. So it was just an amazing, you know, it's just an amazing book. And it's a long book. It's like 500-600 pages. But
well, same thing with 1493. You are not going to be done in a night.
No, that's... little thing. But...
because there's too much... there's too much information. You can't. Everything can't be put into a pamphlet.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have to. And I think it's more difficult in aerial in preparations. It is difficult for us to maintain our focus for 500 or 600 pages.
Oh, seriously, I'm ADD girl. I am. You know, And it takes me a lot longer to read than when I was younger, because when we were younger, because we were about the same age, we didn't have as much stimuli as we have now.
No, no.
Yes. We had three channels.
Well, we had a fourth one that just showed a camera panning back and forth across a clock, a barometer, and a thermometer, and then back.
In L.A., we had ABC, of course, ABC, NBC, CBS, and we had Channel 11, which was KCTV, and we had Channel 9, Channel 13, and Channel 5. So we had, you know, we had local stations, this being L.A., and, you know, but it was nothing like it is now. So you didn't have the distractions. You could read. You know, back when I was younger, I could probably read a 500-page book in 2 to 3 days without even,
See, I did a lot of book reading when we would come up to this very house I live in to visit my grandmother, because everything was on an antenna, and hardly any TV signals could cross the mountains. And so there was a lot of time spent, this used to be the back porch where the studio is, a lot of time was spent back here on an old naugahyde-covered couch with one of the hundreds of books that were in shelves around this place, and me just reading and reading and reading and reading. And you're right, it took you places TV and movies cannot begin to take you. I'm so glad we heard from you tonight, Tracy. It's wonderful, and I hope you get to read the book. And by all means, don't be such a doggone stranger. You hear?
Yeah, like I said, I you know, because I know you got to go. But the only reason you haven't heard from me is because I've been sick.
I'm sorry.
And
well, drop us a note when you're sick. I mean, you know, I was there tweeting when that little Republican side belly was going crazy.
We might be having, let's just say, I've been having neurosurgeon issues and spine stuff, brain stuff. I was thinking I was okay. I had a battery of tests ran over the week, and I told my friend, I said, well, if I don't hear from my doctor by the end of the week, everything's fine. Yeah, he called today. They called today. I have to. On Monday. So
you get to worry about that all weekend.
No, I'm just going to drink all weekend. I'm not going to worry about shit, actually. See, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to party like it's 1999, or better yet, that this is the Mayan calendar, and today is March 11th, 2012. December 11th, 2012. So that's what I'm going to do. Because I'm okay. I'm not going to worry about it. And there's that. But I will drop it. If I can't talk or get through on Monday, I will email you, because our appointment is Monday at 9:30. So are you East Coast or Mountain?
East Coast. East Coast.
Okay.
All right.
I will email you and let you know what's going on either way.
All right. Thanks, Tracy. Take care, dear.
To my love.
Bye now. Tracy calling from L.A. It is time to get out of here. Before we do, one little announcement. If you're anywhere near Albany, New York, a good thing to go to this weekend. In Albany, Power Shift, New York, 2012, at the Grand Street Community Arts Center, 68 Grand Street, Albany, New York. Tomorrow, an address by Dr. Sandra Steingraber. Go and hear her. She's been on this program. She is amazing. She is a powerful speaker and has a tremendous message. Sandra Steingraber speaking at Power Shift New York tomorrow in Albany. On Monday, they're going to march to the Capitol and demand an end to fracking in New York from Governor Cuomo. Thanks, everybody, for making all of this happen through your kind contributions and your contributions of your time and your ideas and just sometimes just the quiet of knowing that. I mean, I got notes, and I'll share them on Monday, from folks saying, you know, I seldom write in, but I just wanted you to know that we're still out here. Thank you. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to my head writer, David, in Tennessee. Thanks to John Fox for keeping everything going with the website and helping keeping me technically sane. And thanks to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go there as well as Stop the Ache, STOPTHEACHE, stoptheache.org, and learn about the ongoing work to end the ongoing tragedies that mountaintop removal brings to Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next. Broth time for me. Have a great weekend.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I promised you I'd be back tonight. Here I am. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Horn. I'm Kronken Mon. Der Kronken. Whatever. But yes, thank you to Jim for the recent email wishing me well in Dear D. Das Kronken House. Probably one of my very favorite words in the German language, Kronken House. It sounds like what it is. The hospital, Krankenhaus. Thanks, Jim. This is the Horn. Head On Radio Network. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. America's liberal voice. A little ongoing experiment in participatory conversational democracy that's been going on since, in one form or another, 2004. And I'm awfully glad to be here. And tickled pink that you are there. I have obviously been away from the microphone for a couple of nights. It has just been a couple of nights, hasn't it? I mean, this is one of those where you look up, and you were there, Zeke, and I couldn't reach you, Eddie M. And it all started about, 8 p.m. my time, Friday evening, during the Friday on the Front Porch program we had here. Things have been cruising along swimmingly. When I noted these awful, awful bursts of pain shooting up my right side of my abdomen, and sufficient that when we ended the program, I was drenched in sweat and feeling like, well, something... feeling just plumb, plain off. And having experienced that a number of occasions in the last 4 or 5 years, at least, okay, what I'm going to be... well, Bob, you need to stop eating food and rest up and drink only water, and right? So I got on the Ibuprofen Express, and I drank only water, and the pain just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse until on Sunday, and this all goes into a larger story, so maybe I'd better, before I dive into it all, again, thank you for joining us this evening for the conversation, and let you know that I am going to try to get 3 hours of radio done this evening, but that it may prove difficult or impossible to do so because of the pain involved, which is in my gut. Although watching the various sundry forms of ignorance, broad spectrum stupidity, and generalized hatefulness that pervades the percentage of this country that makes up the right wing is enough to make anybody's gut sick. Mine is more particularized and localized. I will also offer this disclaimer and make sure that everyone has a vote in this and a say-so. Because there really is. There's an element of participatory democracy in this little conversation that's been going on for these many years now. I have been, since Sunday, on some humdinging, world-beaten medications. They are the sort of thing that, could he have gotten into my room, Flush Flimball probably would have suffocated me with a pillow to get.
Ah, give me that tube out of your arm, Kincaid. That's the good stuff. The Big M. I want it.
And then again, at $50 million a year, maybe he can... maybe he can just... Maybe he's still sending someone out to... maybe he's still sending his maid out with a cigar box full of cash and to come back with a cigar box full of street drugs. You can get away with a lot at $50 million. But I think the thing that, well, never mind. But anyway, you've got to vote in this, and if I start sounding like I'm doing drug-addled Limbaugh radio, feel free to just drop me a note, bobkincaid@gmail.com. That's bobkincaid@gmail.com. Bob, you're sounding a little drug-addled there.
Well, that's the sort of thing of the Foster Brooks kind of, oh.
Right. Hopefully I won't. Hopefully I can keep my together for 3 hours and get a program out. I have not had pain medication since about 7 o'clock this morning. So understand that there's a certain reality that comes with that too. But I can't stand it when I'm away from this microphone. It drives me nuts. I actually managed to... I thought they'd say, oh, yeah, shut up. But when I got checked into the hospital, I actually asked them on Monday morning if I could pretty please have the login for the wireless internet, and they actually obliged. And so there I sat Monday evening listening to Malloy, and I felt like one of the Who's in Whoville on top of that little puff of fluff, screaming, I'm here! I'm here! Only nobody could hear, and my tablet wouldn't let me into the Malloy chat room, and but it's probably just as well I didn't get in, because I would have probably, I don't know, started long digressions on the colors of the things that popped into my world periodically. Or, I don't know, maybe, things being such as they are, I would start hallucinating flying knees or ember of the wing. freaks.
So there you go. But I will try not. I will try earnestly not to sound like Limbaugh on a hopped out of his brains on pharmaceuticals, all ready for a all boys weekend trip to the Dominican Republic.
Who does he when he does that? Who does he leave in charge of taking care of the wife number whatever that it is that he keeps in the pit?
It puts the lotion on its skin, or else it gets the hose again, my friend.
I don't know. Not sure who I feel sorry for, the woman in the pit or the little boy in the Dominican Republic. I don't know. But anyway, it's frustrating for me to be away from the microphone. And I apologize for my absence, but in a way... Well, let's put it this way. It is one thing to do talk radio and talk about issues that one thinks are important to this country. It is another entirely to unwillingly become a part of those issues. Now, I certainly did not go off seeking to be a part of this issue, but as I made the decision to go to the emergency room on Sunday, it occurred to me that I, by God, had, because I am. Here's the setup. Ordinarily, perhaps I might have waited until Monday and just gone down to my local clinic and told them my symptoms, which were not the first occasion of my symptoms. Horrendous belly pain with particular locality that on four or five occasions in the last 4 years has been diagnosed as pancreatitis. And which they then hand me a handful of heavy-duty narcotics and tell me to go and eat no more. It's really the principal dieting method that I've used over the last 4 years. And so I go on clear liquids, and we work our way up to chicken broth and Jell-O and popsicles, and slowly but surely, and then a little bit later, it doesn't take long usually. Never does with the addict. I'm back out on the street hustling for macaroni and cheese and pulled pork. But the problem is, we don't have anybody in our clinic who can even write a prescription. We don't have anybody in our clinic who can say, okay, Bob, you know the drill. Go home, bed rest, go sleepy by, water only, remain hydrated, no food for about 2 weeks, buddy. It'll be great for you. You'll lose about 20, 30 pounds. And then slowly back into until we're talking about your macaroni and cheese problem again. Okay? Because our physician's assistant is gone. Our nurse practitioner bolted for another small community that's closer to her home. We never get to see a general practitioner. And so I knew that if I went there on Monday, what kind of a response I would get. Well, that's great for you, Bob, but you need to go on over to the emergency room because we ain't got nobody here. Because, see, if they'd had somebody in the doctor's office, I could have at least plunked down cash and paid for the appointment. You might recall I told you the story of Agnes's rear-ender car wreck back on the day before New Year's Eve of 2011. It was an absolutely sunny, beautiful, bluebird-perfect day, December the 30th, 2011, when my lovely wife, driving in my rusty red pickup truck, some 16 years old, with some 100 and,
36,137,000 miles on it, was stopped at the intersection of our road, blinking to turn left, waiting for oncoming traffic to clear so she could do so, when one of the pillheads from our community plowed into the rear end of the truck at full speed, you know, at least 55 miles an hour, and without so much as touching his brake. God knows what would have happened to my darling wife and my beloved son had they not been in that 16-year-old giant piece of Mexican iron that came by way of Detroit. I told you the whole story about going to the emergency room with them and being there till 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. And New Year's Eve, and go listen to the program if you want to. It's in the archives at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Well, the upshot of that was that a few weeks later, toward the end of January, I suppose, maybe early February. No, it was early well, I don't remember. End of January, early February, the insurance company settled up on the property damage of one 16-year-old rusty red pickup truck with some 136,000 miles on it. That made it possible, that, and believe you me, please, when I tell you that the sum of that settlement was no great shakes. It didn't allow me to go out and say, you know, buy that Maserati for which I have, long, yearned. No. It didn't even allow me to go out and try to purchase a truck of equal vintage. Sorry. What it did, however, do was to render me, you know, Bob, was to render me too wealthy. No, I'm not kidding. Too wealthy for Pofolk's health care coverage in the state of West Virginia. This is one of those brutal states, you might recall. I think there are 24 of them in the U.S., in which a single man with no job, no home, no assets whatsoever cannot qualify for Medicaid. The only reason I qualified for some level of Pofolk's coverage was because there was some sort of presumptive determination made that our teenage children were better off with a father who was alive instead of dead. For many, if not most, of the poor in this state, that determination is not made. They are deemed better off dead than having Pofolk's coverage. So that was, without a doubt, in the back of my mind when I finally looked at Agnes and kind of grimacing said, okay, let's go to the ER. This is going to be a $5,000 cash bill that I have no idea how we're going to pay, but I think we got to go. And so we did. And like I told you, I expected that that I knew how this thing would go, because on at least four occasions, perhaps five, they all get kind of hazy and run together in a sort of opioid mix after a while. I'd had the same outcome every time, being treated like an ignorant, beer-swilling hillbilly, being told to not drink, even though I would look at them and say, I don't. The first time I looked at it and said, what, no apple juice? No cranberry juice? No grape juice? Nothing? No water? and having had it explained to me that, no, I need to stop my evil ways and... And that had been said to me every other time. And then I had been fired up with some intravenous fluids, a couple of bags of fluids, to make sure I was nicely rehydrated, because I always dehydrate in these circumstances. And then the kidneys start aching. And now, this is not going to be an hour of me talking about my personal aches and pains and woe is me. That's not the purpose. But I get sent home and told to stay in bed, mind my own business, let the world go by outside, catch up on some good reading or whatever. And let the pain... Yeah, because one of the reasons for the pain meds is because it significantly blunts your appetite. And yet it does so without making you feel, you know, get that taller, smarter, faster, stronger, better-looking feeling that stimulant anti-appetite drugs bring on. And that was what I was fully expecting to have happen when I registered, God knows, as a member of the vast millions of Americans who are uninsured in this country. I figured I would likely get perhaps less than that, that be handed an apple and a road map and best wishes, hail fellow well met, and on down the road. That is not, however, what happened. I went in, they did the usual thing, how much do you weigh? Weigh too much. What's your blood pressure? What's your temperature? And, you know, tell me where it hurts. And I did. And then something strange began to happen. The lab results began coming back. And lo and behold, there were there was my white count. Significantly, not dramatically, but significantly elevated. There was some numbers on my various enzyme panels. Upper than one might hope to see up. And then the physician's apprentice or physician's assistant or magician's apprentice or I'm not sure what he was by that time, because the intravenous medication and its accompanying anti-nausea drug had kicked in. The anti-nausea drug, something like Zoolander or something, I don't remember. And the guy began pressing around on my belly, and then he did fun things like bending and contorting my leg and leaning over me as if he was trying to limber me up for the gymnastics final at the London Olympics. And then he slapped me on the bottom of my foot, and I said, "Hey, Doc!" And then he leaned over and pressed way in on the other side of my gut from where my appendix should be, because the other side of my gut from where my appendix should be is where my appendix actually is, and let go, and I went, "Whoo, Jesus!" That's what rebound pain feels like. And then I made a mistake. Where'd you learn a term like rebound pain? I looked at him and said, "I didn't just fall off the turnip truck, Doc. I did have 4 years in college and 3 years in law school." "Oh, no! And all the blood drained out of his face the minute he heard law school. I should have just said, because Agnes was trying to do it for me. "I'm a nurse. He learned it from me." But the minute he heard law school, he got this look in his eye. He got this look in his eyes like, "Oh, dear me, it looks like we may have to get the red hot poker diagnostic set out. We've got one." Never mind the fact that I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on the radio. And then everything changed. And another doctor came in and did undignified things to me that I will not describe to you, except to say that I still feel undignified about it. Because apparently that's another way of checking for appendicitis, even when one's appendix is on the wrong side of one's body. And they came in then and said, because by then they'd sent me off to the CT scanner to have another horrifying dose of radiation pumped into my body so that they could get another picture of things that they had at least a series of, new from Time Life, Bob's insides. See the lack of change over time. But they wanted a fresh one. And in the meantime, the nurses came in and put, because I told them exactly where it hurt. And the minute I told them exactly where it hurt, they pushed in on that to make sure that it really did. Woo! And then another one would come in. Does it really hurt that? Woo, yeah! Hey, Charlie, is this the place? Poke. Ah! Ooh, that's an interesting place for him to have pain. I wonder if it'd happen if we did it to him twice. Boom! Oh! But, like I said, then they did something they have never, ever done before when I have shown up there with Mapo Folks coverage. Because that's usually the part of the program where they walk in and say, "Sir, do you drink?" And I say, "No." And they say, "Well, you need to quit anyway." "Do, sir. Have you talked?" With it, they're white, and look at it with the boys underage, screwed up wine. Your pancreas is what. At which point they and me. At which point Agnes would become furious. We talked about what happens when Agnes gets furious on Friday night's program. That you might involve words like run. But we go home, and I fall in love with things like water and instant chicken bouillon. Suddenly, with me, uninsured, on the hook to pay them cash money, not some agreed-upon rate from some insurance company or government bureaucracy, but real, live, hard, cold cash money, they walked in and said, "We want you to stay a while, Bob. Can you do that for us?" At which point I was grimacing and looked at him and said, "Mm-hmm, okay." And away we went. With visions of mounting numbers running through my brain, and me thinking, how in the sweet name of Jesus am I ever going to pay for this? And because of the nature of what I do and what we talk about, wondering what, you know, how many times, how many millions of times a day that same terrified question must run through some American's mind in this country. How are we going to take care of this? And I looked at Agnes and I said, "How are we going to take care of this?" And she said, "Shut up, Bob. You know, it's that tender, loving, warm, nurturing bedside manner that makes Agnes the magnificent woman she is, and must have certainly made her the truly dedicated and, yes, stunning in the nurse's uniform nurse that she was. No, Lottie, I wasn't worried about the yummy hospital food, because I knew I wasn't going to be seeing any, because at that point, I had not had food since 4:30 Friday afternoon, and had not had water since about, 8 p.m., and had been begging all along. Water? No, not just yet. We might have to take you to surgery. And water? No, not just, we need to keep your belly empty, and we're giving you IV fluids. What, are you not grateful? Water? No, I don't think so. Sorry, my mouth began to get
very dry. I mean, it just feels a little bit like getting in column.
And away we went down the hall, and I answered a series of medical history questions that, for all I knew, the wrong answer to which would be accompanied by waterboarding. And listened as they said, "All right, we're going to bring you some morphine now for your IV drip. And a little bit more Zoolander to keep down the nausea. And we're going to give you a bag of what's it called? Rocephin, just in case, just to cut down on whatever that nasty infection was." By this time, they were telling me I had a UTI, and I'm like, "How?" And I've got Frank Zappa in the playing in the back of my mind on the little MP3 player in my brain, singing, "Why does it hurt when I pee?" And, I think I got it from a toilet seat. Really? A UTI? What? And interestingly, Agnes was still there when they were hanging the Rocephin and everything. I would find out later that they had not charted that they had given me the Rocephin, but the order for it was still in the chart, but nothing noting that they had actually delivered it to me. That kind of thing leads to, overdoses. And so Agnes, in a state of pure unmitigated exhaustion, finally, at my insistence, went home. And I fitfully tried to sleep. Not with much luck. Because every time I would successfully doze off, and I absolutely refused to put on that groovy hospital gown, I laid there in my khaki trousers and my button-down shirt, because I felt like as long as I didn't look the part, I wasn't really in the hospital, because I've successfully avoided being in the hospital in large part for most of my life, though with the exception of a trip there against my own will when I was 3 or 4 years old, at which point they removed my tonsils. I still remember it vividly. And so I would doze off, begin to have some bizarre-ass Samuel Taylor Coleridge-esque opium dream, vivid, the full-function Technicolor. Nothing makes sense. Salvador Dali ain't got nothing on the dreams I was having. And then somebody else said, "Bob, excuse me, I need to take your temperature and your blood pressure. Bob, excuse me." And, as soon as they got done, nod back out. 2 minutes later, "Bob, I need to check your blood sugar." "Bob, I have a patient quality survey for you." "Bob." And so finally, I just sort of opened my eyes and by force of will, pulled the lids back and sat there staring at the wall with you know, some Willie Nelson song playing in the background of my mind. And feeling progressively worse. And telling them early in the morning, folks, I take a blood pressure pill every day. And not getting it. So that somewhere around 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon, they took my blood pressure and said, well, would you look at this? It's 150 over 110. Whatever could possibly cause that? How about not getting my blood pressure medicine? No, Lottie, they didn't wake me for a sleeping pill. They woke me to tell me that they were adding more stuff to my IV, which they could actually have done, and I never would have noticed it. But no, the hospital is no place to get me rest. And so, with my blood pressure somewhere around 150 over 110, they finally decided late on Monday that I could have what they referred to as sips of water. It was earlier on Monday that little old uninsured me had a conversation with the surgeon that had been consulted on this, which was the whole reason that I had been admitted in the first place, who said, you know, I'd really like to have an MRCP or MRPC, MRCP. I said, well, great, doctor. I hope you get one. Is that is it Italian, German? I favor German sports cars. Who knows? And he explained to me that it was a very specific MRI of the little ductal area between the liver and the gallbladder, and the stomach and the pancreas and so forth. And I said, oh, well, maybe it doesn't matter if it's Italian or German, or maybe you'll be getting one after all.
You're as beautiful inside as you are out, Bob.
See, that's what makes her a beautiful and incredibly hot redheaded nurse. And
you know I'm checking up on you, right?
As long as you don't check me like they did in the emergency room. Well, no, I don't know. I'll let you. I got no shame left.
See, that's why I love you.
I had some little student back there watching that when it happened. I was like, make her leave, please! And anyway, so they did that test, and they and I'm thinking, if a regular MRI is a couple of $1,000, this one that has the funny-looking the belly plate that goes over, it's probably $6. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to say welcome to Walmart for a long time to pay this one off. And anyway, the doc by then later had sat down and said, show me again where it hurts, which I really appreciated, because he didn't reach over to press the, you know, press the make Bob's nose light up button. Woo! Instead, he let me do it for him. And I said, well, let's see, if you come down here to my sternum, there's my sternum, and come down here past that pointy solar plexus place that's the rubbery part of a chicken breast, and you put about 4 fingers there, and I pressed in and went, ha! And I said, and then you start walking that over to my right like, ha, 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 ha! He said, that's where it is, huh? Yeah. And a floor doc had come over and done the same thing to me. And then he just reached under me like he was going to, you know, I don't know, fireman's carry me right off the bed or something.
And he just reaches under me and pulls up and said, "That doesn't hurt." I said, "Not like the rest of it does. I mean, it's annoying as hell. I wish you would have asked first, but no." "Hmm," he says. "Hmm," says I. He says, "You know, your pancreas lays really, really deep inside your body." I said, "Even if your insides are backwards?" He said, "Well, that's just your colon. It's not all of your insides. Everything else is where it's supposed to be." I said, "Okay." He said, "Your pancreas lays way deep inside, and if you had pancreatitis, when I did that, you'd have been on the ceiling calling me names." I said, "Well, you know, just wait a minute. Poke around a little bit more, and I can oblige you on the name calling." Yeah, I was thinking about the same thing, Lottie, in the chat room. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom, by the way. It's free and it's easy. Lovely community of folks who real-time conversational aid in electronic print during the program. Lottie is one of our chat room moderators, and he said, "You're lucky it wasn't a teaching hospital, or you would have had a line of students pressing on it to see where it hurts." Yeah, they sent a student nurse or something in who was there to assess my vitals, and I just said, "Oh, hell with it, do it." By that point, my dignity was in tatters. And so, the one doc had told me about how deep my pancreas was, and this other doc, who was a surgeon, said, "You know, that's in all the wrong places to really be full-on pancreatitis." And I said, well, whatever could it be, doctor? He said, "I think it's your gallbladder, personally." I said, "Well, bless my soul." Because, see, 4 years ago, Dr. Agnes had said, because she was furious, "Bob, I'm pretty sure it's your gallbladder, honey." So Dr. Agnes was confirmed. And that's basically the whole story. Monday evening, I actually got a tray of so-called clear liquids. This featured a styrofoam cup of sugar-free green Jell-O, a sugar-free popsicle of some sort, a can of ginger ale, and two things of juice, a cup of hot water, and an envelope of bouillon. Yeah, this doesn't sound like food porn, does it? No, me neither. A bag of quite possibly the worst decaf. Gary, it was a decaffeinated orange pekoe, cut orange pekoe, and cut black tea with what tasted like must have been toenail clippings in it for flavor. I ate the Jell-O, I ate the popsicle. I didn't touch the pop. I read the ingredient labels of the juice to make sure it was 100% juice or that it contained no high fructose corn syrup. I've been rather persnickety about not tormenting my pancreas with that poisonous garbage. And they came, took that away, but they were allowing me to have water, so I was making the best of a bad situation. And I got to listen to Malloy, and it was the whole Horton Hears a Who thing. "I'm here. I'm here." And tried to doze off again. And I found out another thing. Because I had never had morphine before. Suddenly I had Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit playing in the background of my mind, you know, with that little snare drum going and the sort of reverby, what sounds like is probably a semi hollow bodied electric guitar. And Grace Slick's voice going in the back of my mind. But I found out that it has a hangover. And quite frankly, I don't ever want it again. Because I don't usually get headaches. But my God, what a headache I got. and it was with me until about 9 o'clock this morning. Just a thunderous headache that made it felt like there was some sort of little demonic Keebler elf behind my right eye that was just trying to push the eyeball right out of its socket and kicking me in the head when he wasn't successful. But that's mostly the story. By about 11 o'clock yesterday morning, they had turned me loose. And by the way, let me take this moment. I was able to tweet a little bit along the way and Facebook some. And lots and lots and lots of kind good wishes came in on my Twitter and Facebook accounts. And I want to thank everybody for that. This being prayer meeting Wednesday, you thought I'd forgotten, didn't you? Well, I mean, yeah, come on, the narcotic haze is not that thick. How long have we been doing prayer meeting Wednesday, right? Right, yeah. But it reminded me of that business in the book of Matthew, chapter 25, that no one in there with their right-wing fundy Bibles seems to remember. That says, "Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungered, and ye gave me meat." Well, he didn't do that. "I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink." Well, not that either. "I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me." Well, for obvious reasons, I couldn't have anything to eat or drink. I guess I was pretty strange when I showed up at the desk there. More importantly, I was sick, and y'all visited. You put the internet to quite possibly its best possible use in helping to alleviate the fear and suffering and misery of a lone individual. And it really is important. See, that's not a magic zombie talking. That's a human being who has a profound and deeper understanding of the human condition than many of those around him did at that time. You know, it continues, "Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee?" The king shall answer and say unto them, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you've done it unto one of the least of these my brethren," and I was feeling pretty damn least, thank you very much, "you've done it unto me. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and you gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you took me not in. Naked, and you clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and you visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? And then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into under everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal." Even if you don't buy into the rest of the magic hoodoo zombie stuff, that makes pretty doggone good sense, doesn't it? Truly. And I was reminded. I was reminded by you who so kindly, so sweetly, so nicely just said, get well, Bob. Cindy, noting insurance money for your wreck is not taxable income. No, it's not taxable income, but it is an asset, okay? In the brutal world of insurance, and in the case of the sort of half-hearted attempt at universal insurance for the poor that is Medicaid, it is countable as an asset. That is why a person who has no job and no assets can still not get Medicaid in this state. And I don't. And neither do the boys under the bridge. And that's just the brutal reality. My dear friend Holly, on one of my Facebook comments, said, "Ooh, that's right. You live in the largest developed country in the world that doesn't take care of its people when they're sick." Yeah, really. Sort of calls that whole notion of civilized into question, as I noted in that exchange. But first and foremost is to thank you all for all of that. Second is to note that, you know, we've got that verse there about the lake of eternal fire that is reserved for the devil and all his angels. You'd think that a country that insists, whose right wing, evangelical right wing, insists that this here is a Christian nation founded on Christian principles. Well, by golly, if the country was founded on Christian principles, well, wasn't that Matthew 25 business Christian principles? If you've done it unto the least of one of these, my brothers, you've done it also unto me. If you've not done it unto one of the least of these, my brothers, you've not done it unto me. I mean, it doesn't get much more Christian principle-y than that now, does it? No, I don't think so. So theoretically, you could answer all of these right-wingers, well, you know, and there was one of them the other day, he's running for Senate in Arizona against Jeff Flake, who is running for the seat being vacated by the incredibly freakish John Kyle, who said, insurance is a privilege that you own. Earn. Insurance is a privilege that you earn. You mean just like salvation? That Calvinism stings when it hits you real sharp-like. But yeah. Yeah, that guy's a real goober. Of course, we've got some fine, upstanding Christians on the Supreme Court of the United States of America, and you know, we call them the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, every last one of them a good Christian, some of them so good that they're Opus Dei and may walk around with little pieces of barbed wire wrapped around their leg because it hurts real good and Jesus-y. And yet they sat there. You don't want to read. You don't expect us to read all 2,400 pages about these disgusting sick people, do you? No, Jesus does, but we don't. Wouldn't you love for that comment to have been offered to Fat Tony Scalia, whose daddy was the lead principal supporter of Mussolini in the United States? Now, we don't expect you to, Mr. Justice Scalia, but Jesus would. Yeah, how's that feel underneath that hair shirt, Mr. Justice? This is a brutal country. This is a scary country. And just for something like... Now, I'll grant you, I had a little board that was right in front of my eyes that said, today is, and the weather is. By the way, did I mention I got up Monday morning and it was effing snowing? Yeah. Big, along about 4 o'clock in the morning on Monday, what had been a soaking sideways drizzle with temperatures persistently falling turned into snow that was... wet, heavy snow that landed on branches that already had leaves on them and snapped them across roads and just pulled down power lines and all kinds of fun stuff. Which led me to look out the window and just begin using all the fun words. Because I've been waiting for it to happen. I told you, as sure as God makes little green apples and if you eat too much of them, you'll get a bellyache. It would happen. Right after all the diligent and good gardeners got their tomatoes out, then the god of irony would just poke them with the little finger and go, you're going to buy all them plants all over again, sucker. Right. We never plant the old timers always said you never plant your garden in the state of West Virginia until Memorial Day. It seems such a waste of some very nice weather that could come along. That you get to a couple of days. Because, you know, all that came along, landed on the garden plants, killed all the garden plants, and then it was gone by noon, and the temperature was approaching something around 70. That was a sneeze you didn't want to hear. But this is a frightening country that is willing to let people far more ill than I simply suffer and die. And the people principally responsible for doing that call themselves Christians and talk about how health care ain't no right and talk about how the free market is the best solution. I've got to find me a free market solution here sooner rather than later for getting me, and this is such a great big fun word, a cholecystectomy. It means a gallbladder removal. Laparoscopic, preferably, where they blow you up like a balloon and they go in and snip it out and pull it out through a hole and you can never wear a Speedo at the beach again because you've got all kinds of little tiny scars over your abdomen. Not that I was planning on wearing a Speedo at the beach, mind you. But if that's going to happen, well, you know, Jesus saves. All others pay cash. And so I don't know if it's a matter of, you know, they'll take payments from me, my heirs, and assigns forever at $10 a month or what. But everybody I've talked to said, oh, Bob, when that nasty little thing comes out of your body, you're going to feel so much better. But yes, in the course of the conversation with the surgeon there, I said, you know, this has been driving me crazy because I'm trying to figure out what I did to bring this on myself. Because I really did. No matter how much I keep continuing to try to recover, that old Calvinist urge is out there to figure out, you know, to try to figure out what sin I committed that the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky decided to punish me for. And the only thing I could come up with, really, was that while I was in Washington, D.C. last week, on two occasions, in the Dirksen Senate Office Building cafeteria, I had availed myself of the macaroni and cheese and the pulled pork with barbecue sauce on the pulled pork, not the macaroni and cheese, and hot sauce on both. And the greens, the collard greens, with little slivers of onions braised in, cubes of tomatoes that were heavenly. As the hunger really began to kick in, I began to absolutely freak out for some of that good, cheap Mexican restaurant salsa. I think I would have just upended it. Oh, and it was funny when my labs came back, because lo and behold, there it was. Sodium, low. Yeah, me, Bob Kincaid. Mr. Cholesterol, but I've got low sodium. And so that was why my body was saying, you know, we'd like some salsa, Bob. Nah, we don't care what the little gallbladder bastard thinks. We want some salsa. It's way up on the list for when I get past popsicles and chicken broth. Cheap Mexican restaurant salsa. With no high fructose corn syrup, thank you very much, or no corn maltodextrin, if you please. My head writer David in Tennessee caught the Speedo reference. Speedo? Really, Bob? You or... in a Speedo? I can hear the smart-ass kid out at the beach now. Hey, Mommy, when does the balloon go up? Yeah, the really white, pale balloon. Yeah, Marty, I guess so. In other words, your sin was gluttony. And the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky said, oh, well, you know, we've got all kinds of evil pulling the world, murdering children and stuff, but I'm here to work over the fat, pale man there down in West Virginia. But then, in this kind of way,
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
The phrase they use at Accretive is achieving payment through what they call revenue cycle operations. Gee, and I thought they just did surgical operations in the hospital, but now they're allowing these walking bundles of filth to do revenue cycle operations. In the Minnesota case, there were daily meetings at the hospitals of the Accretive spies, and Accretive embed spies with high collection tallies were rewarded with gift cards, you know, not even real money. Those who fell behind were threatened with termination. Anyone who's ever seen Glengarry Glen Ross understands the principle behind that. It was September 2010 when an Accretive staffer wrote, "We've started firing people that aren't getting with the program." Here's where it starts getting infuriating, the New York Times story. Collection activities extended from obstetrics to the emergency room. In July 2010, an Accretive manager told staff members at Fairview Hospital that they should, quote, get cracking on labor and delivery since there is, quote, a good chunk to be collected there. Or, as the prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, might note, that's a good dollar. Reading directly from the article again, employees were told to stall patients entering the emergency room. Did you get that? Stall patients entering the emergency room. You're entering the emergency room because you are in a no-shit emergency. But to stall them with life itself on the line, to stall them in hopes of getting them to agree to pay a previous balance as their life ebbs away. Employees of Accretive in the emergency room, for example, were told to ask incoming patients first for a credit card payment. Could you make a credit card payment? If that failed, the employees were told to say, "Well, if you have your checkbook in your car, I'll be happy to wait for you." Because, see, I'm a nasty person. I espouse nonviolence. I believe in nonviolence. But in those circumstances, like the way I was feeling Sunday night, and I was not subjected to any of this. I want to be very, very fair to the hospital. They didn't give me any grief. They said, "You're registered, and we'll call you as soon as we can get to you. It's very busy tonight, sir." And in a state as desperate as West Virginia, busy indeed it was. But if somebody like that sat down next to me in the emergency room and said, "I'll be happy to wait for you while you go to your car and get your checkbook," I'd say, "No, you come with me to my car, because I don't have my checkbook out there, but I do have a ball bat, and I'm going to destroy your goddamn kneecaps, you profiteering son of a bitch. Because you're screwing with me while I may be losing my life, and I have no mercy whatsoever for yours." The New York Times story contains the account of Marcia Newton, who has a son named Max, who needed ear tube surgery in November. She had been one of those blessed stay-at-home mothers in Corcoran, Minnesota, that Ann Romney is so fond of. Although she also says she loves it. Did you catch this? She loves it that there are mothers out there who can't stay at home with their children, but instead have to go out into the workplace. She said she loves that. Maybe she could have added, as George Bush did in Minnesota, that it was uniquely American to have two or three jobs and still not be able to make ends meet. Oh, Ann Romney, you're just a darling. Marsha Newton went to the hospital in November for her son Max's ear tube surgery. She had never been asked to pay for care before receiving it. She said they were really aggressive about getting that money up front. And then she found out that these so-called hospital employees were really embedded spy debt collectors. And she said, you really feel hoodwinked. One hospital employee told Ms. Swanson, the Attorney General of Minnesota, patients are harassed mercilessly. They maintained something, Accretive did, maintain something called a stop list. They were shadowed, these people on the stop list. They were shadowed by Accretive worms. To keep them from seeking treatment. In March 2011, doctors at Fairview Hospital in Minnesota complained that the strong-arm tactics of Accretive were discouraging patients from seeking life-saving treatments. The Accretive official said that the doctors' complaints were country club talk. It remains to be seen whether the Barack Obama administration, and in particular his Attorney General Eric Holder, will empower some U.S. attorney for the district of wherever to tell these stories to a grand jury and pursue indictments. A few words, if you don't mind, if I have not already over-filibobstered my welcome. A few words now about Accretive Healthcare. As David in Tennessee notes, there's a little bit of justice involved here. Once the story broke, the Accretive Health stock plunged 40-plus percent. Oopsie, investors no likey. It needs to plunge some more. And yeah, David, I'm not sure that it isn't excretia health care. They do, he notes, behave rather shittily, don't they? Just ask him. Hear, hear. No, stories like this send me off and running down the rabbit hole of trying to find out, you know, when you read about a company that is that slimy, you want to find out how it got to be that slimy. So, hey, it's 2012. They've got a big old self-congratulatory website. They say, for instance, Accretive does, that they have a passion for their clients. Let's listen in. Do tell. Don't be shy.
So, here we are today, and I'm really happy. This is a treat to have Mary here. I have known Mary for, 10, 15 years. I knew her when she was at Accenture. I have known her since she started Accretive. I've been on the board of Accretive, so I've seen the Accretive story. And I guess, you know, the first question, since you probably or may not know what Accretive does, is, you know, what does Accretive do?
Accretive has two primary business lines. The first is to actually help not-for-profit, all providers, but the vast majority of them are not-for-profit, hospitals and large physician practice groups get all the revenue that was really due them in the first place. And that's a very enormous and complex process. It's end-to-end, so it starts with the time that the episode of care is being scheduled all the way through to cash.
You know, it's end-to-end. It starts, It starts with the little babies being born in the OB department, and it ends with people clutching their guts in abject misery, thinking maybe they're dying in the emergency department. Yes, it's end to end. That's one of those business school terms that the 1% like to throw around.
And we can more than double a hospital's operating margin. The second major piece of the business, actually, we just signed our inaugural deal in this innovative area, but we are...
By the way, I should tell you, Mary is Mary Tolan. She's a very clippy-speaking, bleach-blonde predator who, in talking about getting the hospitals all they deserve, is willing to, within the freight of that statement, make clear that she's into making sure that the people who are actually suffering don't get what they deserve, which is the value of their billing. Or, shall we say, life-saving treatments desperately needed. You know, because it's much easier to file a claim against an estate, after all, isn't it?
We are helping healthcare providers actually become accountable care entities and being able to take on the responsibility for the health of populations and the cost of that care. And so we just signed this deal, and we're really helping every aspect of people, process, and technology to put providers in position to really change the game on delivering care quality and costs.
Right. By putting, in position, in putting people in position, that means putting verminous, little, squirmy, crawly, vile, hateful debt collectors in emergency rooms to make sure that people on the stop list don't try to get care for that screwed up gallbladder or that rotting pancreas, or maybe keep them from getting that cancer diagnosed until it's metastasized past the ability of any medical science to treat it. You know, putting people in place. Like in graves.
I was surprised at the degree to which I would really develop an affection for not-for-profit executives. It's interesting. Like,
oh, did you hear the host just chuckling? Oh, the affection I would develop for not-for-profit executives. No, Mary Tolan, the affection you developed was for the money that not-for-profit executives had the ability to bring your way. Right?
They're your customers.
Yeah, they're my customers. And, you know, you think about the not-for-profit space as maybe being a little complacent and so forth. And what I learned is that they're incredibly dedicated people who are very mission-oriented and mission-centric. And
those are fun little phrases you learn in the MBA world. Mission-centric. Makes it sound like they're flying to the freaking moon, doesn't it? Mission-centric.
They're very easy to work for. I mean, you really respect what they do and the way they look at things. They're very focused on the clinical side of things, as they should be. But when you get a chance to do something really important for them on...
You know, like putting verminous spies in ER and OB departments who can twist people's lives around their fingers while they are in moments of profound extremis. You know, that kind of thing.
On the side of the business that's the business side that can really get them more outcomes, it's really fun. And they really...
Fun. You get that? It's fun. This is the CEO of Accretive Health describing as fun the ability to torture people who are in agony. This is the for-profit model of healthcare. I don't care if she's talking about non-profits or not. Because this, she is damn sure not a not-for-profit. She is for-profit all the way. And it's fun when people suffer. It's fun to put the screws to them until they weep at the mere thought of having to go to the hospital and face one of those stalkers who have a stop list in their hand. It's fun.
They really appreciate what we do. What actually has not been tried before, and what we are working on directly right now, is empowering the physicians who are the expert decision makers in this.
Oh, wait, they're empowering physicians. Oh, my God. What are they? Are they passing them a needed diagnostic tool? Are they handing them that funny little rubber-headed tomahawk thingy that they check your reflexes with? They're empowering physicians. No, I don't think so.
Market. To actually have incentives and all the information and the operating structure to really integrate the care for the sickest people.
Yeah, what that means is they look at the doctors and say, listen, thumb fingers, you like that country club membership, don't you? You like those vacations you take, those golf vacations in the Caribbean, don't you? Well, stop with the damn country club talk while we squeeze some money out of these deadbeats that come in into this not-for-profit hospital looking for you to actually pretend that you give a damn about them. Get out of the way and let us get to work on our profits, Doc, okay? International listeners to the horn, are you hearing this? Is this just shocking to you? This is the reality of America. This is America, the America where everything, including the agony of the suffering, are deemed a portion of the profit motive of a so-called free market that feeds on human flesh. We take children into whatever little bit of history they have, and we teach them, for instance, about the Mexica people. You know, one of my favorite cultural studies. You know, the Valley of Mexico, 500 years ago, wiped out by Cortez, that bunch. And we say, you know what, as if to sort of say they had it coming, they earned it. Well, they did human sacrifice. They carried people up to the top of the pyramid, and they just cut their hearts out and fed them to their filthy, filthy little gods. And it wasn't that awful? What's the difference between them and Mary Tolan? Wouldn't you love to find the parents of Mary Tolan and look at them and say, what did you do to make this individual so ungodly evil? We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Fee-for-service medicine has actually been causing us on the margins to consume our delivery system in a very suboptimal way.
Now, this woman is a one percenter, yet she refers to herself as us on the margins. Sister, you wouldn't know the margins if they came up and begged you for spare change. Us on the margins. I was only able to buy one Couturier-designed suit this week. I'm living life on the margin. I've only been to the Caribbean once in the last year. I don't know if I can take it, this life on the margins.
Only society that actually pays providers to do things. We shouldn't be surprised that we do more. What a physician doesn't have today is, let's say, a primary care physician that might have 1,100 to 2,500 patients on their patient panel. They don't really have the full line of sight to all the data on those patients.
But you do, don't you, Mary?
All that resides over with the payers today. And they really don't have any incentives to try to hone in on who are the 100 patients within that patient panel that are going to really drive all the population costs next year. And that's exactly what we're doing. We have the algorithm.
Because those people need to die. And Mary Tolan, oh, what, Mary Tolan? You've got the algorithms? Oh, good for you.
Algorithms that will predict which of the 1,100 patients, which 100 we should really focus on so that a physician doesn't have to be reactive.
You mean you've got a computer death panel, Mary? Why, yes, you do. I can't stand any more of this vile, filthy, and disgusting woman. You might want to know that the mission and values of Accretive Health is that they have a laser focus on excellence. Accretive Health's mission, to strengthen the financial stability of healthcare providers through excellence. Wait a minute, I think we've got the wrong voice for that. To strengthen the financial stability of healthcare providers through excellence. Best people and leading technology, thereby increasing healthcare access for all. You know, especially the verminous, creepy, crawly, blood-sucking little healthcare espionage agents that they embed deep into the bowels of not-for-profit hospitals. Now, let's talk a minute about Mary Tolan. Prior to assuming her current role, Tolan was a leading partner at Accenture, the $16 billion global management consulting technology service and outsourcing company. She was the group chief executive of a $2.3 billion global operating group. Back in 2010 maybe? She was named a distinguished alumni of the University of... Oh, wait a minute. It all makes sense now, doesn't it? Maybe it wasn't 2010, but she's been named a distinguished alumnus of the... Alumna of the... Because they've got it wrong here. A distinguished alumni. She was named a distinguished alumni. Alumni is plural. It's actually alumni, A-L-U-M-N-I. She would be a distinguished alumna of the University of Chicago. That sick pile of bricks temple to the psychopathic hatreds and misanthropies of Milton Friedman. She also received Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year award, and she was a member of Crain's Top 40 Under 40. Why, she serves on the council for the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago and on the Board of Trustees for the University of Chicago and, of course, her dear old undergraduate alma mater, Loyola University. Loyola University? Wait a minute. That sounds like it might be a university founded by people who believe in that zombie god who said... If you've done it under the least, not done it under the least of these, off to the lake of fire that was prepared for eternity for the devil and all his angels. That Loyola? That Loyola. And by the way, just because I know you'll love it when I mention this, she serves on the board of Chicago's Lyric Opera. She got a bachelor's of business administration degree from Loyola and then an MBA from the U of Chicago. I love the arts. And I want there to be a Lyric Opera of Chicago. I really do. But Lyric Opera of Chicago needs to get its board together in a goddamned hurry and vote her ass off of it. Because I don't care if it's Pagliacci or Manon Lascaux or Madame Butterfly or the Magic Flute. Nothing needs to be mounted at Chicago's Lyric Opera that has the blood, and misery-soaked money from the filthy altar of mammon that Mary Tolan gives it. Maybe there'll be a little belt tightening involved, but you know what, Lyric Opera of Chicago? Find every penny she's ever given and give her a check back for it and say, no thank you, you vengeful, hate-filled virago harpy. Bye now. So, what an interesting little first-hand experience I had with the healthcare system to couple with this more third-person understanding of healthcare in America today. Take this to heart. This is America, as the Repiglicans, as the so-called conservatives, as the evangelical Christians want it to be, where people are tormented for money before they are ever allowed to see a physician to deal with them and their broken leg, or their kids' need for tubes in their ears, or to diagnose that lump in granny's breast. This is the America that the right wing loves and says is the best country on earth. Where a millionaire says she exists on the margins. Ron and Raleigh writing to say, the margins? Bob, she could only afford one pair of Jimmy Choo's and she had to leave the Manolo Blahniks on the shelf. Poor thing. Darlene writing in says, this woman is full of shit. You said her name was Mary? She's probably a Catholic, named after the Virgin Mary, who was all good. And then, a few minutes later, also from Darlene, aha! Loyola! The Jesuits! We're getting warmer! Oh, warmer indeed, Darlene. Warmer indeed. David in Tennessee noting, subject line, funeral directors. Bob, this is the extension of the undertaker's advantage over to the ER. In the way back, no family would skimp on mama's casket, and now that position of power is translated over to that ER moment. Yeah, they're just pushing the time envelope back a little bit, aren't they, David? Greg writing in, subject line, stand your gown? In reference to over-aggressive debt collectors, do we need stand your gown legislation? Yeah, see, we're the liberals. We're the nice people. We won't do that kind of thing. But, oh yeah, my checkbook and my car? Yeah, come with me. Two walk in. You know, to the parking garage. Only one comes out. Phase 5, Robert from Australia says, Bob, what I'm hearing is shocking. Subject line, by the way. They really can't do that here. Bob, what I'm hearing is shocking. And I hate the meaningless corpse speak she is using. Private health insurance cannot behave like that in Australia because we have Medicare. And because the people would probably burn down corporate headquarters if they found out. Could you send a few Aussies over here, Robert, just to teach the American people how to quit being sheeple and actually get pissed off at the Mary Tolans of the world and make her just brown up her undies once in a while out of sheer fear of the people that she is tormenting? This woman shouldn't be able to go to sleep at night without wondering what would happen if one of the people that she has had tormented, perhaps to death, or their family, should find out who she is and what she does. Randy noting, you seem to be reasoning perfectly fine, Bob, aside from your other health issues. Thanks for the affirmation, Randy. Wow, what a filibobster. My apologies, but I just felt like every last bit of this had to get said. Oh, and by the way, just one last thing, and we'll open the lines for the remainder of the program. One last thing. Now, what I've been dealing with for the last 4 years, and this, you remember a few weeks ago, when Cheney got his new heart? You reckon there was an accretive worm there? Mary, my boss Mary would like to ask if you brought your checkbook with you, or does the old one over here, the evil one? Yeah, I know he carries a little.